Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've always been everything other than who I am. I don't want to lie and live another day in this disguise. I want to risk it all.
Welcome to Friday, and welcome to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Each week, Brenda brings you interesting guests and timely topics to uplift and motivate you to be all that you can be today and for all your tomorrows. Join Brenda and Alive to Thrive every Friday at noon Central Time, right here on Greater Good Ministries Radio. And now, here's Brenda Fraser.
Hello, and welcome to Alive to Thrive, the last Friday here of March, and finally getting some sunshine here in the Midwest. Very excited to have our guest today, who's with us here in St. Louis, actually. He's been well-known in financial circles and in the banking world for the last 20 years, excelled in business and finance as the chairman and CEO of Pulaski Bank in St. Louis, and was also on the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C., but has been most noted for recently for a bestseller book. His first book, actually, right out of the gate, became a bestseller. It's called Thought Revolution, How to Unlock Your Inner Genius. And it came out just exactly a year ago by Changing Lives Press. And I have not been able to put this book down. So I'm very excited today to welcome William Donius, also known as Bill Donius. Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Great, Brenda. It's, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I've, you know, heard about you in the community, and I knew you've gotten many awards over the past few years with being one of the most influential St. Louis personalities. And but I've really admired your volunteer work, your work with various nonprofit groups, since that's my passion and my background, and also your work with human rights issues and social justice causes. So we'll talk about some of that. But let's get right into talking about the book, because not many first-time authors have a bestseller book on the New York Times bestselling list and Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and so forth. Did you have any idea this book would be as successful as it's been?
No, not really, actually. It was the intention was to share a methodology that had worked really well for me. And when I did over 200 interviews over a four-year period, I discovered that this work really was resonating with people, and they were getting a lot of value from it. And so I thought that it had potential, and I also tested it in some business settings and saw some potential there as well. But I just was so interested in it and excited about it, I thought, well, whatever happens, it's going to be good just to have something out there kind of documenting what's worked for me and what's worked for others.
So going back, can you trace back to who first introduced you to the work of Dr. Roger Sperry's discoveries about the left and right brain functioning?
Yes, I can. It was my therapist, Dr. Jean Harper, here in St. Louis, was helpful. And 14 years ago, when I was seeing her, she gave me a book by Dr. Lucia Capaccioni titled Recovery of My Inner Child, and of your inner child, actually. And that was really helpful and eye-opening, and used the same methodology that I've described in my book as the way to tap into the right brain was in her book. And she's actually written 11 others over the last 30 plus years. So this methodology is out there. It was also in a big book by Betty Edwards titled Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. But what really surprised me is that, and sort of as a business person, after I used it for 14 years, I thought, wow, it's not crossed over into mainstream or into the business space. So my thought was to take a bit of a different approach and try to, you know, make it more accessible to people.
Well, I think you totally did that. And interestingly, I had seen a business coach back in Denver probably in the early, like, 2000, and she had introduced to me this concept, and we had only a couple of sessions, and unfortunately she got cancer and died pretty quickly, and I never got to really go through the process with anyone, you know, and she was the first person that had ever started talking to me about inner child issues, you know, never considered any of that, and it seemed, you know, like a foreign concept when I went to talk to her about growing my little small business. But your book, I think, takes a lot of wisdom and science from the past 20, 30 years and puts it in such a simple-to-read, easy-to-understand format of about 150 pages. I love that you make a very complicated subject very simple to understand and very accessible to both the business world and to anyone who is wanting to break out of some patterns and tap into their inner genius, as you say, and their inner intuition. So what were some of the things you noticed during those 13, 14 years that you were applying these methods, first in your personal life and then in your professional life? What shifts and transformations did you experience?
Well, that's a great question, and I'll say before answering it that I wish I could say it was simple writing the book, too, but as a first-time writer, I struggled trying to find the voice and trying to edit it down, and I had a lot of great professional help from the publisher's team and making that happen, but it really started for me 14 years ago, tapping into the reasons why I was unsuccessful in relationships. Although I was fortunate to have been successful in business, and things were going really well. I had just become the CEO of the bank, and things were going well. And I didn't want to necessarily write off my personal life and think that, oh, I'm one of those that just is going to be successful in business and not in my personal life. So I went into therapy to try to get some understanding of what wasn't working and what I was doing wrong, or, you know, just some awareness. And the combination of the therapy, which I always recommend, and the book was really helpful at helping me to figure out what I had missed otherwise. And, you know, and it had been basically almost 20 years of you know, not figuring it out, and which I've noticed with others, too, as I've done this work, we can get into these patterns that, because they're familiar, we're more likely to stay in them, even if they're not necessarily working for us. So that was true for me. And once I resolved those issues and made progress and got the awareness and figured out what wasn't working and what was kind of broken and what wasn't serving me well, I was able to move forward in my personal life, which was great. And then I guess maybe years went by before it dawned on me that this same methodology that is a thinking methodology, essentially, a way to tap into the right hemisphere, which is the creative, more intuitive, problem-solving part of the more artistic, musical part of the brain. It works so well in my personal life that I'm sort of surprised that it took me a couple of years to think that maybe this could also work in business. And it's rather unconventional, which is maybe why I didn't think it would necessarily cross over or work as well in business. So I started attempting to use the thinking process on business problems that I was facing as the CEO of a bank. And lo and behold, it was the same process worked as a way of helping me to think differently, solve problems, and come up with different solutions, different ideas, more intuitive ideas. You know, we always say in business that we have to trust our gut, but oftentimes we're not really so good at doing that.
Well, I love your example in your book about whether to expand your bank into Kansas City or not, and that you had a lot of positive feedback from your team and from your, you know, you were thinking this was going to be the right time to make the move, and then you applied some of these techniques, and then you thought you got some different information. And so basically to use our whole brain is to tap into this this knowledge that's there, this inner wisdom, this source of untainted wisdom that's not locked into the ego sort of way, that to use the left and the right, you get a better decision because you're tapping into information you may overlook. And I love that point that you said that we dismiss our intuition, we brush it off, and unless we take the time to do some of these techniques and go back and look at the answers that we've come up with in our journal writing, we may miss something that could help us. And I think that was a very important point that you made there.
Yeah, I agree, Brenda. I think that I'm glad you made that point, because it's not really, when I do this work with in the Fortune 500, I especially have to remind them that it's not that one side, the left hemisphere, is good and the right hemisphere is bad, but it's really the notion of that we need to use both. That left hemisphere is great because it's the linear, logical, analytical, mathematical, all those great skills that are important in business and in life, you know, putting food on the table, making the car and house payments, all that stuff. If we didn't have those skills and that part of our brain functioning, we wouldn't, you know, do very well in today's society. Yet, if we ignore the right hemisphere, that is, you know, what Einstein described as our sacred gift. And his own words were that we're a society that's forgotten the gift and honors the sort of faithful servant of the left hemisphere. So he was a big fan of right hemispheric thinking, and it was really Dr. Roger Sperry's work beginning at Caltech in the 1950s that opened all of this up, and his Nobel Prize winning discovery in 1981 that the hemispheres of our brains are actually separate and independent from one another. So this is something that, you know, it's becoming more well-known in our world. There have been lots of popular books on it. Most recently, probably in the biggest book, was probably Daniel Pink's A Whole New Mind, which really cites the importance in our conceptual age of today, the importance of right-brain thinking as a way of really getting innovation, ideation, disruption of complacency, disruption of conventional thinking is so needed today in American business and or just global business too, because of the global competition. It's tougher. You know, we see companies like GM going through bankruptcy and IBM and upstarts 30 years ago like Apple Computer becoming the world's most valuable company, Facebook, Google, all these, you know, startups coming out of nowhere, inventing, innovating, and becoming very successful, valuable brands that, you know, are intertwined in our daily lives. So how does this happen? Where do these ideas come from? You know, how do the old companies that have such a huge advantage kind of stall out? And then these other companies just come in and do very successful. And that's also true in our personal lives. You know, how do we get into a rut and maybe not get out of that rut. And scientists would say that we become very encultured in our habits and routines and very ingrained. And so tapping into the right brain is a way to give us literally give us a independent perspective so that we get a sense of like, okay, does this make sense? Why are we doing it? What's there? And so it's very helpful because none of us like to hear from someone else that we're doing something wrong or could be doing something better, right? So hearing it from ourselves, though, in the form of a question that's answered and shows up on the page in the form of an answer from the right hemisphere is different, though, because it's hard to dismiss what our own brain is telling us, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And I like that you mentioned Apple, and in your book you mentioned about Steve Jobs being, you know, one of the greatest business leaders of our generation, and he claimed that intuition was more powerful than intellect, and the importance of quieting the mind and living in the present. How do you approach the Fortune 100 companies that, do they seek you out, they hear about you, or do you make a cold approach by contacting the CEOs and saying, hey, I have this methodology, I'd like to come and work with your top management? How does that work?
Well, fortunately, and this is all relatively new, I took it into businesses in St. Louis beginning in 2009, were the first guinea pigs, and those went well. And I've since spoken at conferences and joined a firm that has Fortune 500 clients that they've taken me into their clients, and it's been essentially word of mouth, people contacting me, because it's very hard to crack into these companies. They're, you know, they get approached every day by a million people for a million reasons. So it's at this point it's still a pretty novel concept, and so it really has to be through a trusted source or referral that's mm-hmm. happened. But one comment about Steve Jobs that I think is interesting, as you pointed out, he believes so much in the notion of intuition, and that he went to India and spent an entire year, he states in the biography, of how he spent that time really delving into his subconscious, learning how to tap in, you know, dropping acid even, and you know, doing this deep dive, and it worked for him. He developed a different thinking style that helped him think differently and innovate and essentially create products that many of us didn't know we needed or didn't know we needed that much, and had the confidence to pursue it as well. And so, as I like to say, that's very inconvenient for most of us to have to spend a year in India or drop acid, and so it's much easier to learn a process that works for us for how to tap into the right brain, of which this is one. I suppose there are others as well.
And some of the thinkers and philosophers throughout time have touched on aspects of this that you bring up into your book, and you mentioned about Ben Franklin's moral algebra, and I just thought that was really neat. I've always done pros and cons list, but I never knew that other piece, you know, to put the question above the T and to cross out those of equal weight and what's left in the balance is the best answer. It was like I was missing that part of the recipe. I don't know how I ever, was told that throughout my whole life, you know, and I think a lot of us that are, you know, we consider ourselves well-rounded, you know, well-educated and have, you know, gone to business seminars of all types, but some basic stuff from people from history. Have you been reading these various books of thinkers and philosophers for a long time, Bill, or did you?
I guess I confess I'm probably a geek that way, and that since college and business school, I've had an interest in all sorts of management and kind of human potential topics. And 14 years in California probably only aided and added that interest. But I think you make a good point, though, Brenda, in that you know, how is it that, you know, and I think the answer is that we're so busy in our everyday lives that we don't often have the time to spend to do these deep dives and to learn more about how weighted matrices can help our business decisions and how that's a derivative from Benjamin Franklin's original work, and how just using more algebra is an easy way to kind of make a better decision, just like we, most of us, have never heard of what's been around, you know, and Sperry won a Nobel Prize for it, for God's sakes, in 1981, but yet none of us, or most of us, when I go, and I've spoken to about probably close to 5,000 people now in conferences and speeches around the country, is that very few have heard of this technique, and fewer still have actually used it. So how can so effective, like Franklin's Mora algebra, and that date back, that, you know, that dates back to the 1700s, and that still hasn't been integrated. So I guess it makes sense that the understanding about how we can use our brains differently and how we can specifically activate the right hemisphere, it makes perfect sense that, you know, many, you know, probably 1% of the population knows anything about that.
Well, and it sounds like you're coming from a place of service as well. I mean, you're not just going into these companies with a profit motive. You're going into these companies to actually affect transformative change and to help them get unstuck if they're stuck. And as you said, to be able to be more on the cutting edge, to be more innovative, to continue to be relevant. The world is changing so rapidly with social media, information changing. And so a lot of these blue chip companies that, as you said, have been around forever, they're now struggling because they keep doing the same things, expecting different results. And as we all know, that's the definition of insanity. And so how do you begin the process working with a company? Do you work with individuals? Do you do more of a group setting? To lead them through some specific exercises, or do you more often go in as more of a keynote speaker?
Well, it can happen in a number of ways, Brenda, based on what the company's interest is. So I've gone in to speak to, you know, 200 in some type of performance recognition event. I've gone into the boardrooms of Fortune 500 companies to work with the top 15 or 20. I've worked with the middle 40. I've worked with, you know, the entire company of 40 or, you know, so it's a lot of varying combinations depending on what their needs are. And for most, you know, and having been a banker and a CEO and very over my 30 years plus and 35 years plus in business, very, very bottom line oriented. So my goal is always to, you know, kind of, quote, get to the bottom line. And, and for business owners, whether it's a big company or a small one, it's always about how can we do it better? How can we make more money? How can we take better care of our customers? How can we take better care of our employees? What have we been missing? You know, is how can we improve the profitability? And so it's generally those themes that are always present, you know, big to small company at every level within the organization as well. And what they like about this work is it's very fast. Unlike holding, you know, series of meetings and meetings and meetings, we're in a culture that, you know, everybody's kind of meetinged out. We go to so many meetings, and they're generally about incrementally minor topics or incremental improvements that are not extraordinarily significant. And the big ideas are missing. Innovation is missing. Intuition is missing. And it's partly because I think, you know, in corporate American business, we don't know how to do it. The how part is missing. Daniel Pink made a great case for why it's important and why it's needed, but came, you know, it, what's come up short is like, okay, so what or how do we do it? And so they like this work where someone like me can go in there and spend typically 4 to 5 hours to maybe a day and a half with whatever group is relevant of their employee base, thinking about how what the company's challenges are and what they've been missing, what they could do better, differently. And it turns out that if you use a different approach, you will get a different answer. And moreover, mm-hmm. not just that they're different answers, they're typically better answers because they haven't thought of them before. So the right brain is helpful in coming up with and tapping into the intuition that we have about our jobs, about our lives, and coming up with things that just didn't show up before. So that's mm-hmm. the real value in a brainstorming session, to activate that other half of the brain that isn't as easy to get to, or, you know, we often have, you've heard it said that we often have our best ideas when we're in the shower or while driving a car mm-hmm. or listening to music, and there's a reason for that. That's the default mode network of the brain. So the notion is, how can we make those moments of insight, brilliance, genius, intuition, whatever you want to call it, happen on demand when we really need it to happen at the meeting, in the session? And wouldn't it be great if it's happening at a time when our peers are there, where we can discuss the idea and do a blend of left brain, right brain thinking, rationalizing on, okay, so I have this kind of crazy right brain idea, but once we start to discuss it and or someone in the group has a crazy right brain idea and they start to discuss it, then the idea suddenly becomes, through brainstorming, becomes much more interesting and much more potentially reasonable and actionable because it's been vetted and discussed, and so these brainstorming sessions are very highly charged and energized. They're very collaborative, participative, and everybody also has kind of an out because they can always say, if it's a weird idea, they can say, oh, this came from my right brain, and people will laugh, and then go, wow, you know what, actually, that's not a bad idea. What if you did this or did that? And so companies have had some really breakthrough insights, including one here, the very first one right here in St. Louis, that in their case, they were able to unlock why they were not successful at selling eyewear from their retail eyewear stores at the upper end of the market. They were able to figure out some of the dynamics over a 16-year period, which had held them back. So that led directly to a 20% increase in profit and in sales. And when the industry was down in the recessionary years of 2009 and 2010, the industry was down 30 to 40%. They were up 20. So it really
Wow. Was. I was going to ask you about some specific cases. And so in that case, was it looking at the customer experience differently, or was it looking at the employee, you know, how the management interacted with employees?
Well, it was a good question. It was a combination, really. They were wise and brought in all 43 of their managers from around the Midwest into one meeting, one brainstorming session where we tapped into the right hemisphere of the brain and also the left, and got a myriad of perspectives, asking really good pointed questions that I understood about the company, and they had to answer them with both with a right brain as well as a left brain perspective. And so they got some really rich information, which led to the breakthrough, which they figured out, which had basically been undiscovered for 16 years.
Now, do you find when you approach a new business situation, they may want the results of they may want different results, and they're in the mode, they're seeking, they want to do this process, but that initial stage when you actually get in there to work with them, is it difficult for them individually or collectively to suspend disbelief and have an open mind and go into this and put their past training, their entire life of how they've been sort of oriented in the business world and approach this with an open mind?
Yes, in some cases, but fortunately, and let's say in a group of maybe 200, there are generally five or so that mm-hmm. can't suspend the disbelief and are so type A maybe that they just can't let go and allow this process to work. So we typically take them out and have another person work with them and do some coaching, and then they usually, you know, rev it up and get and relax. And it's also harder being in a room of 200 of your peers too, right? So that's not fairly easy. But they're able to fire it up relatively quickly and, you know, 20, 30 minutes or so and jump back into the group. I find that it is helpful to give, I typically give a short talk at the beginning of the program that's perhaps 40 minutes, but it includes three interactive exercises that helps people understand what this is, how it works, why it works, some of the history and neuroscience, and a kind of condensed version to get them in a space where they're willing, I think, to try this. And then the whole rest of the 4 or 5 hours or day and a half is spent delving into questions and answer processes and discussions and collaborative processes. So it's very interactive.
Well, and it sounds that, you know, you have the credibility from your own business background and now the success of the book to go in there. I think someone else who may know this material might not be as successful as you are doing this, because you have had hands-on experience in the business world and with boards of directors of various sizes. I mean, you have had experience being on a business board and then also on boards of nonprofit organizations, both small, regional, and national. And those are, you know, you have to have a lot of personal people skills and the ability to engage people to trust you, because they are getting out of their comfort zone and they have to be vulnerable doing these exercises. So I think that's a testament to not only your intelligence on this subject, but your own personal mannerisms that you are able to show your vulnerability. And I appreciate at the beginning of the interview talking about, you know, that you did, you know, seek therapy and you were trying to improve your relationships and trying to understand that. I admire someone that can talk about that, because I think all of us have various issues or various parts of our lives that we want to understand better or change. Some people, you know, hit the brick wall when they have a life-threatening illness, and I have people like that on the show, how they overcame that. Some, it's, you know, financial devastation, bankruptcy, whatever, losing their job that they've had for 20, 30 years. And for me, it was, you know, surviving a car crash in Washington, D.C., where one day my life is one way and the next day my life is completely different. So I think these techniques that you are sharing through your book, and again, I want to remind readers, listeners of the name of the book and where to get it. It's called Thought Revolution, How to Unlock Your Inner Genius by William Donius, and it's available on your website. Is that correct, as well as Amazon?
Well, no, actually, it's not available on my website, but because we don't have a selling mechanism there. But it is available in local Left Bank Books here in St. Louis and independent bookstores across the country, as well as, you know, the Amazons and the Barnes & Nobles and stuff of the world as well.
Okay, so if people want to get it, they should go to Amazon if they live out of state, because we do have listeners from around the country, and to find you on Facebook and to connect with Bill on his website, williamdonius.com, or on Twitter. And your Twitter address is it B. Donius?
That's correct.
B. Donius, D-O-N-I-U-S. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Bill Donius, some fascinating research that he's done over the course of many years and his recent New York Times bestselling book. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Alive to Thrive.
We're open for business. The Greater Good Ministries Book and Gift Shop is now open for business, featuring metaphysical and uplifting books from your favorite authors, such as Doreen Virtue, Wayne Dyer, Michael Edward Owens. We've added handcrafted one-of-a-kind jewelry, pendants, earrings, and bracelets, and now have an exclusive selection of crystals, rocks, and stones for your metaphysical toolbox. Take a look at our hand-dug Arkansas crystals, imported Brazilian crystals, Tibetan crystals, and Reiki healing stones. All of our rocks, crystals, and stones have been Reiki infused, blessed, and cleared, ready for use. You can reserve your copy of Crystal Healing 2012 and Beyond, Reverend B's new book, a comprehensive guide of rocks, crystals, and stones for the New Age. Visit ggmradio.com and click Bookshop in the menu bar. That's ggmradio.com.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Frazier on GGM Radio. And now, back to the show.
Hello and welcome back. We're talking today with William Donius, the author of Thought Revolution, How to Unlock Your Inner Genius. And this is an interesting book that anybody can read and apply, whether it's to a professional issue or a personal decision. It helps think outside the box. It helps you connect to your own inner truth. And I did some of these exercises this morning. The first, it sounds simplistic when you hear it, but when you do it, it's kind of a completely different experience. And the first exercise is, if you were an animal, what animal would you be? And you first answer that question writing with your right hand, and that's your aspirational self, and then you do the question again with your left hand, and a totally different answer comes out. And I was interested, Bill, wondering if you continue to do the same questions for yourself, and do you get different results from year to year, or how do you continue doing this methodology and finding new questions to ask?
Well, thanks, Brenda.
I would first
interject that just in case readers are wondering, our listeners are wondering I usually refer to it in the book as your dominant hand, because although, as you suggested, 92% of Americans, as it turns out, are right-handed, what we suggest is that you use your dominant hand to respond first, and then your non-dominant hand, which for most people is their left hand, to respond second, although you don't have to. But the non-dominant hand, be it left or right, is the neural pathway, as it turns out, to the right hemisphere of the brain. So it's regardless of handed, non-dominant.
Okay.
Yeah. So in my case, it's also interesting maybe to point out that, after doing this work for 14 years, to answer your question, I have integrated it into my thought process, and I don't know if I'm necessarily doing it every day, but certainly every other day, if I have if I'm thinking about something and I just want a different perspective, I turn to this process and pose a question like, okay, well, how could I arrange this trip differently? Or, if I'm traveling on a vacation, what places should I visit that I haven't thought of yet? And just the notion of asking a question is also good for stimulating thought processes regardless of handedness. But when you do use that and you turn to your non-dominant hand, I continually find that I get different answers. The book has 52 questions. So if you really – and I have met with some who have – come to me, and after they've answered all 52 questions, they say, I have some follow-up questions. So you know, it's not that those questions are the only questions. It's really, since it's a thinking tool, it's really designed as a way to just help you think differently about anything, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. And I just was tickled to see in Chapter 4 a QR code. I thought that was just so innovative, and it connects the reader to a sample journal. And I've never seen that done before, so kudos to you for that. And I didn't even know there were 52 questions. I probably, you know, haven't quite finished the entire book yet. So, you know, that's fascinating. I was wondering, you know, if you do still journal, and, you know, you mentioned in the book that it's also a way to connect to your higher power. And I love anything to do with, you know, spiritual understanding, which is completely different from perhaps the religion of our childhood, which for me did not connect me to anything that was spiritual. It was more dogmatic. But how do you connect to your higher power? Do you have a certain place you like to journal, inside, outside, certain notebooks, certain pens, or, you know, certain settings?
Well, I used to probably be more dogmatic about that, but I guess through the years, I've just realized it's more important to be doing it than being overly ritualistic about doing it. So I find actually there are times where on plane rides, where I've done a lot of recently, I find that it's a particularly good time for me, because I'm stuck in, you know, in the seat for hours at a time, and a way to, you know, use the time productively, and I kind of reserve that time, I guess, also to knowing that I'm going to have that time that I would otherwise be sleeping or reading or listening to music, and so I find that I can easily set aside an hour or sometimes more to think about things that are of importance to me, you know, either in a about, you know, things that I'm doing in my life, or, you know, that I'm accomplishing or still haven't accomplished, and trying to find out why. And so it's a way of really becoming much more intentional, because you learn, you know, sometimes we come up with convenient excuses. And as I describe in the book, the lies we tell ourselves about why we're not doing something, why we haven't gone back to graduate school, or why we haven't started saving, or why we still haven't, you know, made up with our parents, or, you know, why we haven't lost weight, or why we keep getting, you know, into conflicts at work. You know, we tend to lie to ourselves because it's a lot more convenient to believe something that takes the burden off of us. So, but when we journal and tap into the right brain and get a different answer, that is also feels different, but it also, when we really look at it, it can sometimes take our breath away. And I've had people actually gasp and or cry in these sessions, where they come to this really a deep understanding of their fundamental truth, and about something maybe that they have been in denial about for so long, that once they see it written down by their own hand on the page, it's hard to ignore. And then it's not a, you know, a one answer and done kind of thing, because it works in a Socratic didactic fashion, so that you can continue to go deeper in answering the question, well, why is that? Well, how come I did that? Well, why was I doing that originally? And where does that originate from? And so you can keep going layers, peeling back the onion, if you will, to get to a point where you have a full understanding of why you've behaved in a certain way.
Well, I think that too is very fascinating. You know, I always saw myself as a happy-go-lucky person, and yet I went to a workshop and I found out my personal lie was that I caused pain. And by the end of the workshop, we had transformed our personal lie to our truth. I bring joy. And you know, I think there is that. Operating for so many people that, you know, self-sabotage themselves with negative thoughts and internal messages that they're not even in touch with. Now, is that what you refer to in the book as the beast? Because you didn't really explain too much about the beast. You said, you know, you talk about capturing it and what, you know, and then this was when you went into talking about uncovering these personal lies. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think you're exactly right, Brenda, that beast is the all of the kind of negative stuff that gets rolled up that we kind of believe and, you know, take on, and it limits us. And for me, you know, I like to think of myself as and I probably definitely was in childhood the kind of glasses half full person. But I think somewhere along the way, school of hard knocks, things happen. You know, there's a tendency maybe in all of us to see a little bit more of the glass as being half empty. And you know, the things happen in the world and society, and we can tend to orient in a little bit more of a negative way if we're not careful. And that beast energy, I think, is that negative energy can kind of take over. And yet it's also hard when you hear people just being sort of artificially sort of saccharine sweet and saying, oh, you know, life is great, blah, 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 and be happy. It's sort of like, okay, yeah, it's great, but I don't feel that way. So really gets at this work really goes to the core of your being, where you really need, I think in my mind, you really need to get to the bottom line proverbially on the personal side, which is why. Why are we behaving this way? Why am I, you know, having kind of a knee-jerk reaction? If it's not a positive, great reaction, why is it a negative reaction, and why does it keep happening? And, you know, what's underneath it? There's a reason for it. It's not just accidental that we're doing something that may not help ourselves or be hurting others. But the frustrating part is that we typically, as smart as we are, we typically don't figure it out. And that's why many people go into therapy, right? Because they know something isn't working and they haven't figured it out, and their friends haven't helped them figure it out, and their spouse hasn't helped them figure it out. So they're, you know, there's something that they haven't been able to deal with, and so they seek help. And I think the tapping into the right brain is a way of getting a different perspective and is a way of getting extra help. It's an independent point of view, and it's coming from yourself, which is why it's so valuable, because that's the really unique part, is that it's you know, in all of the work that I've done in all kinds of different processes and workshops and programs and 14 years at California and managerial programs and business school, I've never found anything that worked as effectively or as simply as this methodology.
And I think it's really hard for high achievers, that people that are successful, as you say, you were very successful in business. And I know other people that, you know, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 14 years. There's, you know, a high proportion of people that are overachievers and always goal setting and the next thing and the next thing. And yet sometimes their personal life suffers. Either they're, you know, workaholics, or they're devoting so much time to their work. And there seems to be sometimes this split. Actually, it even showed up in a couple of my exercises, you know, this division of, you know, how do you maintain sort of that happy wonder, the sense of wonder, that exploratory feel of a child going through the world, seeing everything with new eyes, and that sense of amazement, and then, you know, be caught up in the complicated world of, you know, juggling a lot of appointments, a lot of clients, making money, paying bills, you know, writing books, speaking, all these things. And I think just taking the time to pause, to write, to put pen on paper, that is like an activity that seems luxurious for most, where so many people are plugged into technology 24/7, that, you know, people have gotten away from journaling and writing, and things do get expressed through writing that are not expressed through any other medium, with it seems like more information is coming in from the outside world in, and often people aren't taking the time to just stop, pause, and listen to that intuition, that inner wisdom, that voice there, that's always available to us if we know how to tap in. And as you say, ask the right questions that might stimulate some thinking, and then, do the writing with the non-dominant hand. And then drawing. We didn't talk about drawing at all. Some neat exercises there too. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that applies both personally and professionally to open up some new solutions?
Sure. I'll comment on drawing, and then I want to jump back to something that you said as well on the notion of the habitual patterns. Drawing is takes us out of our comfort zone and takes us into a different part of our brain, and we don't have as many restrictions when we start to draw. So it's been fascinating to me to see people draw pictures in response to the statement, "This is my life now," and then they draw a picture with their dominant hand. Then when they draw a picture with their non-dominant hand that emanates from the right hemisphere, and if they do it right and they're able to suspend disbelief, as you said, and really allow something to flow forth from the brain to the hand, they come up with really fascinating images that are completely different. And generally, they get some really interesting insights from what they draw with their non-dominant hand, because it's something unexpected, and then they can ask the question, "What does the drawing represent?" And then when they answer that with their non-dominant hand, they get their surprise further, because sometimes what they see in a literal interpretation, there's something happening on a figurative level or a metaphorical level that is different than they otherwise thought that they were drawing. So it's really fascinating how complex, and scientists are still figuring out stuff about the brain that is perplexing and interesting, and learning new things daily practically. So it's a cool way of thinking differently by drawing. I want to jump back to your notion of being in these habitualized patterns, and there was something that got edited out from the book in one of the six drafts along the way over a period of years, with the notion of the winning formula, and that's been used by organizations to describe that which works for us, and we do over and over because it helps us in one part of our lives, but then it may begin to take over, but because we're winning in that part of our lives, we stick to it. And it may be the reason why, as you described with those DC folks that you knew, that they, were very successful in their career, so they just stick to that. And because it's working, they're winning, it's a formula, it's working, and they ignore or disregard the other stuff because they aren't success there. So this process, and you mentioned technology makes it easier to get distracted. We seldom put pen to paper anymore because that seems old-fashioned. But those processes of quieting the mind, putting pen to paper, journaling, whether it's just the dominant or non-dominant hand, but using this process adds, it basically like doubles the firepower of the output. And it's a way of getting much more in touch with what our intentions are, how we can be authentic in life, what we're missing, what we haven't thought of. So I think it's very important to return to this. I know Arianna Huffington, who I've met along the way and invited me to blog for her 5 years ago, and I've done so since, is really big on this notion of we need to really get back in touch with who we are and get back to basics and simplify. The Huffington Post has this GPS for the soul, which is great, a lot of items on this topic. So I think people are kind of rediscovering the importance of this, and it really is important.
I love that, and I'll have to read more up on her and the GPS of the soul. That's really neat. So have you applied these techniques to any of the nonprofit organizations, board of directors that you serve on?
Yes, I have, and because you're right in your supposition that this was a way for me to give back, and when I retired at 50, I wanted to do this work and then also do more travel and rebalance my personal life because it had balanced too much towards business and not enough towards a healthy balance. So I've worked hard over the last 5 years, and I'm succeeding at the rebalancing portion, which has been great. And I do take this work into nonprofits and donate my time to help them. And I'd rather do that, actually, than serve on the board of directors, because I find that sitting in those meetings after being on 19 boards of directors for over a 20-year period, it's really hard to sit in those meetings monthly, and oftentimes I feel like just the rubber stamp rather than somebody that can help them innovate and think differently, which they really want their board members to do. But, you know, it's the meetings aren't really designed to be, you know, that brainstorming sessions or ideation sessions. So I'd rather donate my time as a and give them one of these brainstorming ideation sessions with the board or the management team. And I feel like that's the best contribution that I can make rather than, you know, just being on the board and trying to be of service that way.
Well, I love that. And I'm working with a company called Give Back Marketing that launches publicly next week. And we'll have to talk offline about ways to involve you with that, because I think that that is such a valuable service and a huge, huge gift to the community to be willing to do that with certain organizations that you have a passion for. Where are you speaking next, and are there any public St. Louis dates coming up in the next couple of months?
One of the great opportunities coming up, it's not until November, however, is I've been invited to lead a workshop at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. And that's from November 10th to the 15th, and it's on their website at esalen.org. And that's on thinking differently, and it's about all of this work and taking it into our personal lives. And there'll also be some by tangential, I guess, exploration of we'll take some of that into people's work lives, certainly, too, because they're so interrelated. But I mostly have been doing this work now in corporate America, where I was just on the last week, I was in three cities across the United States, a week and a half doing this at conferences that are, you know, industry conferences where you have to pay to go. The American Banker Conference was one in Carlsbad, California, and then in private companies in Texas and in St. Louis. And so there haven't been as many because it's a year out, and I think I gave almost two dozen public talks around different places at universities and bookstores and, you know, various places. I do post those, however, on my website. I have an events page and that lists what I'm up to, so that's a good place to check.
Okay. Well, we want to give that website again and make sure people do check that. It's WilliamDonius.com, and you can email him at bill@WilliamDonius.com if you have a question, if you've read the book and want to send him a note, or if you'd like to invite him to your corporation, to your place of business, or to a conference. I'm sure he'll welcome the opportunity to speak to groups of any size and is willing to travel and bring his wisdom out around the country. And do you have any, we have about a minute left, what are the top country you'd like to go to next?
The top country?
Yes.
I think it's a tie between New Zealand and Africa.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. Well, we'll talk more about that. And we so appreciated having you on Alive to Thrive today, Bill. You have a fantastic weekend. And really want to encourage people to get the book. That's called Thought Revolution, How to Unlock Your Inner Genius. Thanks again, and have a beautiful day.
Thanks so much, Brenda. It was a pleasure.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.